Welcome to the Kate and Colby Show,
where we talk about things that matter,
practice the art of coming more alive,
and reflect on just how strange and wonderful life can be.
We're glad you're here. Facebook.
I'm checking right now.
Okay. Hey everyone, this is
this is
our second attempt at a cold open to see if the Facebook feed is working.
There is always something.
It doesn't say.
Oh. Yeah, I'm right here.
We're on Facebook now?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So far
we've had riveting introduction.
Sorry, loves. We're here now. It started the show and didn't have us on Facebook.
For those who come back and might watch this at a different event, you might be wondering, what's with the weird opening? The first time we started the stream, it only went to YouTube. It didn't go to YouTube and Facebook. So we had our YouTubers watching, and we had to tell them, we're going to kill the stream really quick, but come right back because we're going to try this stream all over again. And I think it worked this time.
Here we are.
So we're here. Like you were saying, it seems to be
something
different and fun. There's just to keep us fresh.
I can't hear the guest. Or
just to keep us fresh.
So
we're here now, and let's start the show. So we start the show.
Yay!
This is the cold open. Welcome to the Kate and Colby Show. On tonight's show, we have a special guest, Kate. I did a Kate. I pointed at Kate instead of the...
Oh, yay. See, even you do it sometimes.
That's weird. That's fun.
Pointing
Our
hard.
Special guest tonight is Stephanie Tate, which if you've been with the Kate and Colby Show for
I'm
any
so
amount of time, you might have seen that Steph has been like in the comment section and viewing and a part of the...
And we've been talking with her.
A part of the view crew.
And now we get to really talk.
And now we're like, hey, can you come be our guest sometime? So that's finally happening. And it's happening tonight. We're also going to do a viewer check-in, and we've got a brand new segment that we're going to introduce to y'all here in just a few minutes. So without any more ado, because we've already done a lot... Don't you think? Let's get into it. Welcome to the Kate and Colby Show. Happy Wednesday night, everybody.
Hi.
Welcome to the Kate and Colby Show, and hello, Pod Fam.
Hi, Pod Fam.
Who shall watch this? That's the whole thing, is the Pod Fam listens to it.
Yes.
The View Crew watches it. What's up, View Crew? Speaking of, we've got Melanie in the house. Hello, Melanie.
Hi, friend.
We've got Susan. Hi Susan.
Paul.
We've got Paul Lee coming in hot from Facebook. Shane,
Lauren.
Thanks for coming back to the YouTube.
Yeah, sorry about that.
Irma Jean, good to see you tonight.
Right. Here we are.
Here we are.
How are you?
How am I? I'm good. I'm a little warm.
You've been down here all day.
I've been down here. Oftentimes our garage stays like temperature.
Not when it hits 100.
But yeah, when it hits 100 outside, there's no air conditioning down here. So it's been a bit warm down here. But I've had the fan blowing on me. So, you know, it's fine.
Yeah. If I was down here all day, I'd be a grump. I don't do heat well. My body does not respond well to it, and therefore then my brain doesn't respond well to it. You're like, yeah, I know. You're the worst.
I can confirm.
I went fuzzy.
It focused on the computer. Come back to us. Don't.
Find our faces. Anyway.
Yes. How are you?
I'm doing really well.
How are you as you show up into this podcast space this evening?
I'm doing really well.
Okay.
I have not been doing really well, as you know. And so I'm at a point in my life, though, where I'm getting pretty good at, when that's the case, intentionally doing things to move myself as much as I can. You know, there's what we can control. There's what we can't control. And just walking myself through the stuff I can't control, walking myself through the grief and the processing, and then the stuff I can control, doing things about it. So I had a great day of doing that for myself. And so I feel really just that feeling of like, proud of yourself for the work that you're doing, and then just grounded and centered.
I love that.
So, yeah. I feel more me and present than I have in quite a few days.
Yeah.
It's been, as you know, a lot of not me showing up, just showing up instead of me.
Thanks for sharing that. I've been a bit stressed lately.
Mm-hmm.
And you know how I can tell?
Hmm.
These little patches above my eye, the little skin, the little dry patches
your body
are coming
shows
back.
You when you're,
I'm like, oh, I guess I'm stressed.
Kolb's main way, like me, that's not how I know that I'm stressed. Mm-hmm. I do head spin out stuff and heart crying stuff, but you, it's always like, my neck hurts. Why does my neck hurt? Well, sweet pea.
Yeah.
Or your skin or, yeah.
And I think it's for good reason.
Yep.
The stress.
Yep.
We had our first in-person service this last Sunday.
Yes.
First in-person in, 17 months? I didn't do the math, but I think it's been like 17 months.
Which we went from thinking that we were going back to in-person, you know, weeks and weeks ago when we planned to finally go back. We haven't done any of the, what other churches have done of going back at all. No hybrid, nothing. Just purely virtual to be safe and to include everyone. And then we decided it was finally time to, go back, do it safely, and we were like, okay, we can do this, and then Delta, and oh my God.
Yeah.
So having to, we decided to still go back, but it's like, okay, now we even, even vax people got to be masked, and and making sure we weren't doing any of the other rituals that we used to do that would, bring people too close or too much.
Which were oftentimes the bread and butter of our services, right?
So
the communion where we get to, place the elements in the people's hands and speak a blessing
just
to them.
Getting close to humans.
Getting close
to
them. And then they dip. We had a common cup that everybody would dip into.
Doesn't that seem like a lifetime ago?
Doesn't
that
seem like a lifetime ago?
And then we would, that they were fine.
In the service with everybody holding hands, this big amoeba blob of human connectivity. And, so we didn't do those things. But anyway, it was a lot of stress leading up to it. A lot of stress on the day of trying to handle all the technology of figuring out how to do live streaming with the service.
But it was good.
But I've noticed the last week, I'm like, oh, hey, man, I think you're a bit stressed. Yeah, you probably are.
Yeah.
So.
Yep.
But I'm here tonight.
Yeah, we merged our church and our in-person church. And you, when by we, I mean you. You made them one thing. It's so cool.
It was so cool. Thanks, baby. Can we check in with our viewers in a segment we call Viewer Check-In? Tonight, our question is this. When it comes to stores and shopping, what's one of your favorite stores to shop at and why? So you can respond to this. You can take it any direction you want, whether because you like the actual store itself or because you like what the store sells, or maybe you like online stores and you like to shop there. And here's the reason why I chose, because I oftentimes like to connect the viewer check-in to the theme with our guest. Well, our guest tonight, Stephanie Tate, wrote an article, I think in 2015. It's on her blog way back in the archives.
Hi, James. We're glad you didn't miss it.
Hi, James. About the Ministry of Target. And it was really freaking cool article.
I'm gonna pull it up right now.
It's a really freaking cool article.
Y'all discuss amongst yourselves. I'm gonna read the article.
And Stephanie, forgive me. I'm probably gonna butcher most of what you said. Everybody should just go to
stephanietate.com
and read that article. But it was really cool to how Stephanie's experience at Target was experiencing with her own eyes and hands and experientially noticing that Target seemed to be creating clothing that was more accessible and inclusive, specifically for her son who has autism, who had sensory issues. She's like, man, their clothes, the shirts don't have tags anymore. They have these jeans that feel like sweatpants on the inside.
It is everything to this entirely sensory wrecked human. Yes.
Yeah. And then
I feel the same way.
And then Stephanie talked about how she looked into it, and it turns out years before, Target had hired a person whose job, that was basically their job, was to figure out how their stores were not as accessible and inclusive as they could have been. And so they don't have like the loud music playing over the PA system, and they changed their clothes, and they made their displays less aggressive.
So the fact that I go and walk around Target for hours to calm myself
is by design,
makes
as it turns out.
I'm so happy right now.
I'm gonna cry. So thank you, Stephanie, for writing that article. But that so I was just it made me cry. It made me think, like, what are there stores that you like going to, and do you know why?
Wegmans. It's a grocery store. They clearly label it on their products.
Oh, it put up. I'm watching on the TV. Put up the wrong comment.
Oh, it did.
Thanks, Ecamm.
That's not what I meant to put up.
Wegmans, a grocery store. They
Sometimes
label
that happens,
yes, they yeah. label their products, which is yeah. So that's a great reason because they're very clear about clarity is kind.
So obviously the Target thing made me cry, so maybe that's my answer. But I also feel like I haven't gone to Target and done that in
yeah.
year
kind of
and
a weird
half
question to ask right
pandemic.
Now.
I know. But nurseries I still go to because they're outdoors and can that be my favorite store, even though it's
yes.
not? Mm-hmm. Any garden, nursery, plant nursery. City Farmers is my absolute favorite here. And actually, I think Sunshine Gardens just beat out City Farmers. I'll drive the
Sunshine
45
Gardens
minutes.
Is so
Sunshine
great.
Gardens is so cool. Yeah. We have these amazing farm/nurseries here that are right in the city, full farm, and also plant nurseries. You can go and just see all the animals and be in plant havens. Bill Pitts said one of my also favorite stores for many reasons.
That was what I was going to be my answer, Bill Pitts. Also, hi, Bill.
Hi, Bill. We
welcome back
you.
To the West Coast. I mean, virtually, obviously.
Oh,
I know
was like,
you're way out east. I just mean he's with us.
Are we going to dinner
it's
tomorrow?
It's good to see him again. yes, Costco's one of my favorite to go at because I have just learned to trust Costco's buyers. You know, so they curate their objects and what they stock very intentionally, and I trust their quality, and I know that if anything ever goes wrong with any of their stuff, obviously their customer service is world-renowned.
Wait, you have Pennsy Spices there, too?
Ooh, Pennsy Spices
Pennsy
is
Spices.
Great.
They're amazing.
Yeah. Someone said bookstore.
Surprised? I know, I put that up.
Oh.
The variety and surprise stuff online? Is that about Costco? Is there surprise stuff online that we're missing out on? Fill us in. What is happening? Susan says she prefers to shop online and have for years.
Because of mobility issues. Yeah.
Although going to the grocery store for the first time after 17 months was an experience. I resonate. Going anywhere now feels weird. All right. Cool.
Thanks for checking in with us, viewers.
Oh, thanks, viewers. James came in at the last second and said thrift stores, and I just have to throw that up because
you do love a good
thrift store.
You love popping tags. Before we go any further, if you would like to, this evening or any evening thereafter, support the Kate and Colby Show financially, we invite you to do that by going to buymeacoffee.com/Kate and Colby. Now, why would you do this? Well, for a couple reasons. One, last week it fed us Thai food. After our show, we went and got Thai food because we were hungry. And it's in large part thanks because of the support from you. But that's not really – sometimes it's buy a coffee. Sometimes it's buy a curry. But also, more importantly, it helps to pay for our monthly hosting fees, which have gone up as of late because the more content we put out, the more it requires that we pay for the storage. It helps us to thank our guests. We like to send our guests little thank you gifts for appearing on our show, which I've been on a lot of podcasts and have only one time ever received a thank you thing.
People are
just starting
the world. To do it.
100%. This isn't like a shame on others. It's just like,
it's
we get to do that
do.
In part because we have people that support this show. Yeah. So anyway, you can do one-time donations, which is like, hey, here's a one coffee for the night. Thank you for the show. And it's $5 per coffee, or here's 10 coffees, here's $50, or you can become a monthly supporter, which several of you have done. You've become our baristas, providing coffee on a monthly regular basis, income that we can rely on to make sure that this show keeps happening.
Which is important.
So thank you. Again, buymeacoffee.com/Kate and Colby, all one word. All right. Should we try out our new scene, or our new
You're okay, baby.
Segment? Yes. There's a word out there.
He's There's a word
in the world that I cannot find at all. Okay, now I gotta find the scene. All right, here is a new segment. Let's get into it.
Doesn't matter what we do, just as long we're gonna do something good.
Cause
of course, you made
joy.
The cutest little bumper. That's so great. I love that.
This segment is called Cause
for Joy.
Your
little logo at the bottom. You're so cute.
It's so cute.
This I also like that we're doing this because of our. Oh. Is that what you were about to
go
say?
Go for it. Set it up.
Oh, I just love the title of tonight's episode of The Crossroads, which is Stephanie's words. Crossroads of joy and pain?
Joy and pain.
I just love that. And I can't wait to quote one of my favorite Stephanie quotes later when we're talking to her about that.
Sweet.
But
For now. Tell me a cause for joy, Kate.
Okay, you know what I'm so freaking joyful about right now? This is one of the things that has lifted my mood, and I'm joy-mongering in this because it's a tiny little shift towards progress. And that's what we got to do, right? Because
yes.
Humans are always, like, in our heads and hearts and our imaginations, we're always out ahead of progress. We're always, like, seeing how much better life could and should be, which can make it feel shitty to us, like the world is going to hell because the world hasn't caught up with our imaginations.
Yeah.
So in that tension space, I like to really grab on to little bits of human genius and goodness and hold on for dear life. And so one way that I've been doing that is all of these incredible trials that they have been doing lately in countries like recently with Iceland. And also, I think it's actually what the world's biggest, longest trial for this. So I think also, what are the other countries that have done this? New Zealand and Spain are a few others. But trials for 4-day work weeks?
Yes. I saw that too. Go on.
I'm so excited, uh-huh. y'all. Uh-huh. Colby knows I'm like obsessed, absolutely obsessed with the idea of us humans moving forward, but kind of backward into less work. We have just become work obsessed and we are overworked and obviously, especially in America, but all over the world, we are just driving ourselves into the ground, and we have forgotten rest, and we've forgotten play, and we've forgotten family and hobbies and mental health, dear God, and the environment, and all of those things that I just named, they have seen in these trials. They have called the trials overwhelming success. So they have kept people at their same exact pay, have not changed pay, and people have moved to just working 4 days a week, and not the four, like my dad used to do what they called, four tens,
mm-hmm.
right? And so that's cramming all your work into less days, but that's not what this is. This is truly less hours. It has reduced work week hours by the minimum reduction is 5 hours a week. That's the minimum, but most of them it's like 8 to 10 less hours a week. And they have just seen that people's lives have been flourishing, hobbies, family time, mental health, all those things that I just named. It's better for the environment. And then the companies are like, our production's actually the same or better.
Yes.
And of course it's better because people are better and people need to, anyway, I'm obsessed.
That's cause for joy.
And it's not happening a lot in America right now, but there are a few spots in America. It's
oh,
not
really?
like right now we're like Iceland is doing this, right? Well, we can't say that America is doing this. There are companies and corporations that are wanting to do that just out on their own, even though the country isn't doing that. But even though I live here, just knowing that other countries are doing this thing, I'm a human. We're connected. It's a movement, and it'll catch on. It'll be contagious. It's brought me so much joy knowing that there are people out there that are getting to experience that in freedom. Oh, that just
that is rad.
Makes my heart happy.
That is rad.
That's my joy spot for the night. What about you?
My cause for joy has to do with malaria and mosquitoes.
Cool.
So scientists have figured out how to genetically modify particular species of malaria-carrying mosquitoes. It's called gene driving, and what it does is it introduces a gene modification into the climate for the mosquitoes, and it over like 7 to 10 generations, it leads to basically infertility in that brand of mosquito that carries malaria so that they can't keep reproducing. Like, so we could actually see an end
to malaria.
And that, I think, is cause for joy because malaria, if you've ever looked at the numbers, like, that is a worldwide killer. That is something that, like,
Sorry, I was smiling while you were talking about worldwide killer, but it's because I was reading the comments.
I understand.
Sometimes we have weird reactions.
I was totally fine with what was happening. So this is cause for joy for me. I remember, not for me personally as much because I'm not under the threat of malaria, but millions of people in the world are. Mm-hmm. And now I think that introduces some interesting ethical quandaries. Anytime we get into gene manipulation, I think it introduces it raises some necessary questions around ethics. People, I think, understandably would have perhaps different takes on the rightness, wrongness, okayness, the value of
different takes.
Yeah, of introducing modifications into the gene pools of a thing like a mosquito. But my understanding is the point is not to eradicate mosquitoes. It's just to eradicate the kind that carry and pass on malaria. And I think that's something that most people would say is a good thing. I remember a number of years ago when I went to Africa and slept under a mosquito net for a couple nights. It was some of the worst sleep of my life. Now, granted, that I'm just a white schlub from America who's like, oh, I can't sleep under a net. Right. So I totally understand all the layers of that thing. But it made me, you know, one of the things was, how great is it that when you don't live in a country that is ravaged by malaria, you can just sleep out in the open. And when you do live in a country like that, so many precautions you have to take and so many people that get taken by that bug.
Do you know that there's a flower called the killer chrysanthemum? That's like a common name. That just planting it outside your house can keep away mosquitoes that carry malaria as well as other bugs that cause life-threatening illnesses. Yeah, it's pretty cool.
That is awesome.
It's just a weird fact that I know.
I love it. Cause for joy. This has been Cause for Joy. Working less, producing more, more human balance, eliminating malaria mosquitoes. We're smiling.
We're happy about it.
We're happy.
Okay, it's my favorite time of the night.
Let's get to our special guest. I don't remember where I put the button. There, right there. I made new buttons.
Shocker.
Good Yay! Evening, Stephanie Tate. Hi. Welcome to the Kate and Colby Show as a guest.
I know, on the other side.
Yes.
It's weird.
I believe it. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. You are a delight of a human that we've gotten to observe and read about and mildly interact with. And so when the opportunity came up to have you on as a guest, it just felt to us like, yeah, that makes sense. And then you said yes. So thank you. Thank you for—
Thanks for being here, Steph.
Making space in your time and your life and your calendar to join us tonight.
Fun fact, Stephanie, we met her online during pandemic.
That's correct.
And haven't met in person. But she lives in our old
where
home.
Where we used to live.
Grounds. Yeah.
that is a fun fact.
That's fun.
Small, small world.
And I used to live in California. So
funny.
We swapped.
Just swapped.
That's when did you move to Salem?
I think it was like 7 years ago, eight years ago, something like that.
Okay.
That's funny. That's really close.
That's great. Well, Stephanie, maybe we'll start here with an introduction question, which is to say, let's pretend that nobody in the View crew, nobody on the Pod fam has ever heard of Stephanie Tate. And so now here is their verbal and or visual Wikipedia experience of the Stephanie Tate. To tell us, just would you do however you want to in terms of introducing yourself to our people so we can set the stage for where we might go with our with our time together.
Remember when you asked me beforehand if there was anything I didn't want to talk about?
I probably
should have mentioned I hate this question so much.
We can skip
it. Like, I can be so prepped to go into an interview, and then as soon as they're like, so who are you? Tell us about yourself. I'm like, I don't, who am I? That's a great question. I don't know.
It's the freaking
bail her
worst.
Out, Kate. Bail
I'm
her
bailing
out.
You out by, we're going to do it through questions, specific questions. Does that work better?
There's a reason that I hired Karen to write all my bios, right?
Yep.
Because I can write words about other people. I can write words about a topic. But as soon as you ask me to talk about myself, it's like blanks, complete blanks.
Totally. Yes. One of the things that I know about you and that you have in your beautiful bio by Karen is that oversharing is your spiritual gift. Mm. So I'm laughing about
that
right now.
That's the one line I'll take credit for. I actually wrote that one. So yay.
Nice. I love it. But I'm laughing at the paradox of humans because you're like, oversharing is my spiritual gift. I don't know what to say about who I am. Mm-hmm.
You're in California, so you know, like, growing up in that culture there, oversharing is not a positive thing, right? Mm. I think part of it is I was in the San Francisco Bay Area where everything is crazy expensive compared to the rest of the world.
Yeah.
And so most people are working multiple jobs, they're working long hours, they're very busy with their families. And I think it led to this culture where it's not that people don't want to be friendly, it's that they have such limited time and resources that, like, you have your people and you trust them. And when someone new comes along, like, you don't know if you have time to invest in that and jump in, right? So if somebody pushes right past the shallow and instead of saying, I'm fine, we're good, says, actually, I'm not fine, here's what's going on this week, it's very like, I did not consent to having a relationship with you. I don't know if I have the ability to commit to that right now. Like, please back away.
Yeah.
So it's funny. I say it as half of a joke, but it really did take me a long, long time to see the ability to share vulnerably as a gift, because for so long it was culturally ingrained in me that that was just a very negative personality trait that, it's very difficult to make friends in that culture if you are this kind of a person.
Yep. Oh, I so relate, especially my sweet Enneagram 4-ness. I'm like, let's dive deep. And people are like, ew.
Back off.
What are you doing? You're in my kitchen. Okay, so I'll bail you out with just a few specific questions then instead.
Love it.
Can you tell us a little bit about your family that you live with in your home?
So
who do you live with?
I live with my husband, Bobby, who is the world's most Canadian. Like, he's just stereotypically the nicest guy, right? Like, you need help moving, he's there. You need to paint your house,
aww,
he's there. He's the first one to show up. He's the last one to leave. He's got a smile on his face the whole time.
Is that
one of his
part
hockey
of what
teams,
drew you to him? Did you like that about him, or have you learned to accept that part of him?
I don't know, to be honest. Like, when we met, we were both kind of in periods of transition. And Bobby is hands down, maybe it's Canadian thing, I don't know, he's just the most loyal, like, steadfast, even-keeled person I have ever met. And there was something really appealing. And it's so funny how what you think you want in a partner changes, right? Because if you had asked me even 2 or 3 years before I had met him, I would have been like, that's boring. I want the drama, right? Like, I want you to write me a song. I want you to do a big display of affection. I want the passion. I want the... And then comes along this man that was just loyal to a T and so dedicated and so selfless and just determined to serve other people. And it was... I don't know. There was a turning point in my life where it was like that. That's what I want. I want the predictability and the stability and the knowledge that he's always going to be there. He's just completely my anchor. So I don't know. I think.
Love it. Thanks for sharing that.
I love
that's
that.
That's who he is. And then I have two kids. I have Aiden and Jack. They are, I'm trying to remember, 11 and 8 now. So No, 12. He just turned 12. That's right.
He just turned 12. Literally just turned 12
like a week ago. I know this because he got his vaccine that day.
Yay.
So he turned 12.
Yay.
Cool.
That's great.
That's amazing. I love it. Okay, tell us a little bit about, we put the description of who you are in the episode, obviously, but just tell us a little bit about your work in the world and how you show up on the internet and what you, I mean, your handle is Stephanie Tate Writes. What do you write about? What's your favorite things to write about?
So I kind of wear a lot of hats. You guys know how that goes. I do the author thing, the speaker thing, and I do a lot of what's called disability consulting or accessibility consulting, which means coming into churches, conferences, businesses, and addressing where there may be accessibility blind spots that they don't see. And so things kind of ebb and flow in seasons. Like there was definitely a point where writing was the number one thing that I was focused on. And then it kind of shifted to be more speaking. And then a pandemic hit. So writing and speaking were super profitable businesses to be known. So accessibility consulting was kind of more on the front line for a while. So it's definitely like a jack of all trades kind of thing. I honestly wish I could just be at StephanieTate.com, but somebody is sitting on that and will not move.
Same. It's the realtor in Kansas for me. I'm like, hey, Colby Martin in Kansas, you're not even using the domain. Just use your Keller Williams account. And
whoever's owning mine doesn't use it either and never has. It's just sitting there blank and they want me to pay them a fortune to get off of it. But it would be really long URL if I was like, Stephanie Tate writes and speaks and does disability consulting.com. Like it would be a lot.
And then somebody has that, so you'd have to get
.net. There's just so many things.
Yep. I love it. When you do disability consulting, is that what we were referencing with Target, how they had someone did you hear that part of the show when we were talking about Target?
Yeah.
In your article about Target? Is it similar to what they had someone come in and do then?
Well, in Target's case, they had actually hired a designer specifically for their clothing lines that was coming at it from like the standpoint of how can we make these things more accessible to people with sensory issues and to people with certain medical issues that require adaptive clothing. And what was so neat about Target and the reason I wrote that article is because instead of doing like, hey, we have an accessible line over here in this section for those people, Target went, or we could just integrate all these things. They started out in the children's line and then they expanded it because autistic children become autistic adults. And so having things like shirts that don't have tags or those extra soft t-shirts, or you may even notice things if you go look for them, like tie shoes that also have a zipper on the side, right? So that you can have shoes that have laces and not like little kid Velcro shoes, but you don't necessarily have to have the hand dexterity to tie your laces. Yep. Things like that were just integrated directly into the same clothing line they were marketing to everybody else. So instead of saying you people can shop over here in this carefully curated, you know, mini section, it was how can we just design things that are accessible to everyone? Because inclusive design ultimately does benefit everybody.
Everyone.
Yeah.
And more than that, it's inclusivity, right? Like you don't have to single yourself out to go shop in that special section for needy people. Like, you can shop where everybody else shops and keep your own medical information private and not feel the need to be like sneaking over there if you're not ready to explain that to people. And it means something, right? To have it's not just a separate space. And part of the reason I wrote that article and part of the reason I do disability consulting is I don't think churches are quite caught up to what Target has caught on to, right? That I'm glad to see some churches having what they would call special needs ministry. I hate that term. I don't have special needs. I have the same needs as everybody else. The way I access those needs might look different, but my needs aren't special.
Yeah.
I appreciate that churches are trying to do that. But a lot of the times, even in those spaces, it looks like we can put your child in the separate classroom over here with the other kids like them. Or if our service is too sensory overwhelming, we can put you in this other room where we'll tone down the sound in there.
Yeah.
Right. There's a lot of sort of separate but equal design in there.
Totally.
And so I loved that Target was like, nope, we're not doing
that.
It's
all together.
You're either included or you're not. There's no middle ground. There's no separate section. It's just for everybody.
So this is great because the thing that I was most excited to ask you about is I have heard you talk about what the word disabled actually means and how in our heads we conjure up this idea by putting the opposite as not abled. And I've heard you help us get to where that's not the case. Will you share with the Kate and Colby Show folks if they haven't heard you talk about that? Because for me, I'll just be incredibly vulnerable and honest. It was mind-blowing. I had never thought of that. And that is, I was definitely in the other category of looking at it as if you're disabled, you're not able, like the opposite is not abled, like not consciously, but that's just how we go about the world thinking of it. And when I heard you talk about that for the first time, I was like, everyone on planet Earth needs to hear this. So will you share it? Would you mind sharing that with our folks?
So part of the reason I hate the term special needs, right, is because it's a euphemism trying to dance around not saying disabled. Mm. And part of that comes from this place where people think there's something offensive or insulting about naming disability and saying that I'm a disabled person.
Yeah.
And a lot of that comes from a misconception about what disabled means. So just from a word nerd point of view, the opposite of the word abled is unable, right? The opposite of able is unable, not disabled. Yep. Disabled is the opposite of the word enabled. I'm not able. The reality is that the world is not set up for bodies like mine, and that disables me, that literally holds me back and sets up barriers for me to live my full potential. And there are other types of bodies that the world centers their needs and they are enabled by the world's choices. It's not that they're, you know, automatically set up for success, but they are enabled by the system being set up for bodies like theirs.
Wow.
And understanding that can help us get away from sort of the weird euphemisms, right? Differently abled, handy capable, like, none of these things are actually helpful because, A, if you have a problem with the word disabled, it means that underneath it, you have a problem with disability itself, right? Like if you think there's something insulting about calling me disabled, you think there's something negative or inferior about being disabled. But also, it's that when we use words like special needs or handicapable or we're all just differently abled, it kind of negates the reality that there are actual systemic structural barriers to inclusion in society for people like me. And so, you know, we're all a little bit autistic, right? Like that's not helpful. We all have different abilities and needs. I don't see you as disabled. I see you as so much more than that. Like all of those things ultimately flatten the experiences of people like me and say, you don't actually face any real structural barriers. It's all just perception. And if you just stopped labeling everything, like it would be fine and everything would be great for you. And that's not the reality of disabled experience. So I think it's helpful to sort of get outside of this weird dichotomy and understand that it's not abled versus disabled. It's enabled versus disabled.
Isn't that just
I thank you so much, Deb. Mm-hmm. That's worth the price of admission right there. Buy her a coffee, everybody.
Every person on planet Earth needs to hear that. And Joel, I just want to address, I need to pause and address Joel really quick. Joel, you are so
you're good, buddy.
You're learning with us. So Joel had asked right at a point in the show, had said, I've heard the phrase differently abled before. Is that something better to use? And then right as that comment went up, you spoke to that. And so then Joel's like, ignore my comment. Facepalm. And you're so good, Joel.
I was just in the comment section earlier, but then I left. So I don't want him to think that I was like, I'm talking to you, Joel.
Nope,
Joel, don't do that, Joel. Like, that's
exactly
not what
Joel,
it was.
You're with us. You're learning. That's why, I mean, you just heard me say that when I heard Stephanie first talk about this stuff, I was blown away, so you're good.
Yeah. I'm okay. So I'm. You got to. Yes, I'm having this.
You're having the moment that I was having
of around this phrase and this word, and realizing that to say keep pointing me in the direction if I'm not there yet. But it sounds like what you're saying is that this idea of disabled is less a description of the person and more a description of how their structure has been set up in relation. It's a relational term between person and environment, between person and their own body. So to be disabled
if you want to nerd out, you can go Google it. But basically, and there are other theories, but like predominantly there's two main theories that discuss how we approach disability. And one of them is called the medical model of disability. And one of them is called the social model of disability. Mm-hmm. And this disabled enabled concept is really the social model. The medical model is sort of disability is defined by symptoms and diagnoses and what's quote unquote wrong with my body.
Okay.
Whereas the social model of disability says there's nothing wrong with my body. The problem is that systems are not set up to accommodate bodies like mine accessibly, right? Yes. So you look at examples like the deaf community. The deaf community has rich culture and history, and this is meaningful to them. And so when hearing people come in, they have a tendency to assume, well, obviously, if you were given the choice, you'd want to be hearing.
Yeah.
And that's the medical model. That's there's something wrong with your body. And so the goal is how can we fix it? And that's how we bring you into full inclusion with society. Yeah. Whereas the social model of disability says, maybe the problem is not me. Maybe the problem is you've set up systems and structural barriers that hold me back from complete inclusion. And that inclusion is possible. And it doesn't mean that I have to be healed. It doesn't mean I need to be fixed. It means you need to recognize differing access needs and then accommodate them appropriately.
That's so good. Does that... okay, so two questions. Actually, I have more than that, but let's start with two. I've never heard this before. This is so fantastic. The medical and the social, are they at odds with each other, or are there ways in which they complement? Like, do you see value in as you talk about the medical way of holding it?
Like in certain conversations.
Yeah.
So. Much like other communities that are, you know, built around identity, disability is not a monolith, right? Like there's such a variety of experiences. And so even within the disability community, there is some disagreement about even this concept of the medical model versus the social model. There are other models people have come up with that are sort of a little bit more blended or something else entirely. It's not a totally adequate framework, right, for discussing all of disability as a whole. And there are some values to both. The reality is that there are certain conditions, right? Like if I could give up chronic pain, I would give up chronic pain tomorrow.
Right.
Like I'm not over here like, this is my rallying cry. This is who I am. I love being in pain every day. Like that's not how this works.
Yeah.
So it's not a perfect system, but it's really helpful for sort of getting outside of ableism is in the air we breathe. Like we're raised in it culturally to the point where it's so implicit that we don't recognize we're doing it. So I think this is a helpful model to get people outside of their own heads and their own assumptions that they may not realize they're making.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the times people see accessibility issues and they may express something to me like, you know, I'm just so sad it has to be that way for you without ever recognizing it doesn't have to be that way necessarily. Mm-hmm. Or right, like right now during COVID, I will have people tell me like, it's just such a bummer that families like yours have to stay home without recognizing that families like mine shouldn't actually have to stay home. And also like some people are complicit in those barriers that are keeping my family home. And so it doesn't really help me to hear how sad for me you are. That tells me that you're pinpointing the problem as my body, my immune
once
issues,
again,
et cetera.
Yeah, something wrong with you.
As opposed to what can we do to correct these structural barriers that keep you from full inclusion in society with the rest of us?
Yeah.
I keep. Yeah. You can go. I keep wanting to. I'm just so excited about this.
I know. It's so much.
Can I ask one more?
No, go for it.
Okay. So when you talk about the social model of disable versus enable, is there a scenario in which some disabilities could be eradicated? Like, is that part of the model, part of the casting of the vision of saying there's a scenario in which what we might call a disability now, look, if we
because
get our
the world
stuff in
is
order,
so accessible that it wouldn't
yeah.
any
we can
longer
enable
be,
all the people yes. in this area. And yes. then that's not, is that, am I understanding that correctly?
This is like, you jumped right from like disability 101 to like the meat of like the heavy duty stuff. I'm so impressed. Like the time in which
that's
it
what Colby does.
From, this is totally new to
he
me.
He learned
like,
something.
Let's get down to like the PhD level question.
That's what Colby does.
And it's funny because you happened to bring up the mosquito gene thing earlier.
Okay.
And it's interesting because I actually watched a documentary about CRISPR and gene editing, and the mosquito thing came up as part of that conversation. And this is a conversation that's at the forefront of the disability justice conversation because there's a lot of tension around this. On the one hand, some things could be corrected for us simply by removing access barriers. On the other hand, like I said, if I could give up chronic pain tomorrow, I would do it in a heartbeat. And there are other disabilities that it's not just about correcting access barriers. They really are living with pain in a way that we would like to see them corrected. And so for some of those disabilities, things like gene editing and that technology are a way forward to potentially seeing the end of them. But it's a very sensitive topic in the disability community because where we could wield that technology and where that could go is really scary.
Yeah.
Because what happens when someone decides to eradicate deafness or eradicate autism or eradicate Down syndrome? Like these are cultures, these are communities that, you know, don't believe there's anything wrong with them because there's not. They're just different. And yet we know that once we empower people to genetically remove some of these traits from the population, it doesn't matter if we say you shouldn't do that. It doesn't matter if we try to make roadblocks around it. Like, it's just naturally over time going to happen. And so there are communities like the autism community that legitimately worry that people would try to remove that trait more and more. So it's very much a conversation that is in tension because there are some things we want to correct simply through removing access barriers. And there are some things that we would like to see healed. But once you open that door, it's just really hard to figure out where it stops.
Yeah.
And ensuring
it's what you
that,
were saying, right?
Yeah. That eradicate doesn't basically become destroying entire cultures and entire identities. Yes. And as Christians, I think, like for me, as a Christian, this is really important to me because I fully believe that disability in some of these forms is part of showing this big multifaceted God that we have, that being created in his image means it takes men, it takes women, it takes different genders, different races, different sexualities. It takes all of us to display that whole picture. And that includes disability. Yeah. So when you start talking about the possibility of eradicating deafness or autism or Down syndrome, for me, like I truly believe that there would be pieces and facets of the character of God that we would miss out on because we wouldn't see them reflected in humanity anymore.
Wow.
It's so good. Yeah. We got to pause. We have so much more. Can we have three episodes with Stephanie? Let's do a giveaway.
Oh, okay. Let's do a giveaway.
Tonight.
You have a book and it came out in 2019 and it's called The View from the Bottom.
The View from Rock Bottom.
The View from Rock Bottom, even farther than the bottom. Rock Bottom is down below. So give us the quick pitch on this book. And then if y'all want to enter the giveaway, all you got to do is just make sure you follow Kate and Colby on Instagram and at Stephanie Tate Writes on Instagram.
Perfect.
Let us know you follow us. You're entered.
Just, all you got to do is comment that you did and that you already are. That's fine too.
Yes. Yes.
You're going to go follow me and be so confused because it's just like a year's worth of flower photos thanks to the pandemic.
Well,
and
we're
like, going to
talk about
this.
I'm not letting you
know
leave
this
podcast.
That is the right
flowers.
Person.
We'll get to
you're
the flowers.
You're not on the wrong page.
Flowers are crap.
Tell us about The View from the Rock Bottom.
The View from Rock Bottom was the book that I wished I could find that wasn't out there when I needed it most. So I had Lyme disease for 15 years before they got it correctly diagnosed. And that's left me with a lot of permanent disabilities as a result. And while I was walking through that journey, I, you know, was raised in the heart of white evangelicalism. And so I swung from wondering if, you know, there was some hidden sin in my life and I was being punished, or thinking that maybe, you know, God was trying to teach me some sort of lesson and he would do a big miracle and everybody would see. I swung to all these sort of really unhealthy ideas of why suffering happens in the life of believers. And I finally hit a breaking point not long after we moved here to Oregon, after I had my 7th miscarriage, in which I went, I can't do this anymore. Like, where the hell are you, God? Like, this isn't supposed to happen. I'm doing the things that you told us to do. Like, where's the reward? Where's the safety? Where's the security? Where's any of it? What does any of this mean? And so I did a deep dive on what the Bible really says about suffering. And I was very surprised by what I found. And so I wrote a book on the theology of suffering and grief and lament and bad things happening to good people. And I really wanted to find a book that was not everything's going to be okay because it was okay for me. So just hold on until you get your miracle. But I also didn't want to write a book that was like Tim Keller's Walking with God Through Pain and Suffering, right? Like, everything is ordained, like a John Piper take on suffering, right? Like, God just ordained all these bad things to happen to you. So just be grateful for it and trust the plan. Like, neither of these extremes felt right to me. And I just didn't see a lot of people working out that messy middle, that space and tension where I both believe that this is not God's best, that God did not want 7 of my children to die or for me to live in pain every day. But that also doesn't mean that everything is hopeless and all hope is lost, and trying to figure out where that middle ground was and how to walk that out in real time. So I wrote it as a book, and like 12 people have read it.
Okay. Well, it's about to be 13.
Yeah, or 14. I think we can give away 2.
Are we doing that all right now?
Two winners?
Absolutely. Let's
pick 2 winners.
Okay, I'm going to put them up.
First winner is, let's do one at a time.
Screen.
Anna. Oh, Anna Saturdalen.
Yay.
Yes. Okay, Anna, message us or just message Stephanie.
Message the Kate and Colby.
Message
show.
The Kate.
If
I think Stephanie's, she said, I'll just send them to him.
Oh, that's true.
Do you receive Facebook messages? Like, can people message your profile?
If you could get their info and pass that along to me, that would be great.
That.
Because okay, message the Kate and Colby show and I will
do that anymore.
Yeah. Awesome. Yep. Before you announce the second winner, I'm wondering, and maybe if this is too much of a spoiler, then say they got to read the book. But what's your take on God now? Like, you've had years.
Before I announced the second one?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm sure she can answer that in a sentence or two.
Because that was such a small question. Like, what's your take on God? Like, just one sentence or two.
No, I was being a little cheeky. It's like how if you can give me one contrast of like, who is God to you now on the other side of these decades now of living with this, the pain and the trauma and the cycle of chaos, like how does your view of God now contrast to perhaps maybe before some of the big things hit, if there even was one? I'm presuming there was maybe a earlier version of God in your head that has matured over time.
I think the biggest difference is I'm not looking for an other side anymore. I think so much of me was like, someday when God shows up and does the big thing, or someday when I learn the lesson, someday when this season is over and I get to go to whatever the next season is, then my relationship with God will look like this. Then my relationship with myself will look like this. I think the biggest change for me was coming to a place where I don't look at seasons like that anymore. Like when Ecclesiastes, when it talks about, you know, a season for mourning and a season for dancing and a time for this and a time for that, I think the biggest change for me was recognizing that I had always seen that as this self-contained season for mourning and then this self-contained season of abundance over here, and learning that it's all interconnected and interwoven and overlapping to the point where you really can't unravel where one starts and the other ends, opened up my ability to learn how to see God inside of my pain along with me, instead of waiting for him to show up and do a thing, instead of looking for the ways he was revealing himself in things and recognizing that there is no God showing up in my pain. God was just always in the pain, always alongside me, always with me. And I don't have to get better to find him or see him. That was a very dramatic shift for me. Very dramatic shift.
I love it so much. Remember I said there was a favorite quote that it actually is from her bio.
Oh, what a great segue.
I know. In Stephanie's bio, it says this: for Stephanie, pain has not existed on a spectrum opposite of joy. I freaking love that so much. It has not existed on a spectrum opposite of joy. Mm. Pain, with the way it weaves into our lives, families, and work habits, has been the connecting point of grace and struggle that defines her career. It's in her bio, but I just freaking love that so much because that's who I see Stephanie acting as in the world, living that paradox out for us so that we stop looking for God way out there on the other side of our troubles. And right here in rock bottom, here I am. It's not pain over here and joy over here, and we're traveling from one to the other, but
I think sometimes people come to my book thinking that I'm going to give them like a reason for pain. And I know it's nuanced, but there's a big difference between a purpose inside my pain and like the reason for my pain.
Yep.
Right? Like finding purpose inside of horrible things does not mean this is why this had to happen.
Yep.
Like God gave me Lyme disease so that I could go into ministry. Like that's not how I see God working. That's not the God I see in the Bible. That's not a God I would really want to have a relationship with anyways. Yeah. And I think that's a big mental shift. And again, it's super nuanced and that can make it really hard to talk about, but there's a big difference between finding purpose inside of pain and saying, I'm going to tell you all the reasons that bad things happen to you, so it's okay now because Jesus. Like, this is not that book, and I hope it never comes off as that book. Like, that's literally my worst nightmare. We don't need any more of those books. There are plenty of those.
I'm hoping that entire movement, can just be behind us. Should we announce our second winner?
Yeah, announce the second winner. Second winner is... Bill Pitts Jr. Bill Pitts Jr. I'm excited that you get to read this book. All right, Bill, send us your new information in Florida so we know where to send that to you. Stephanie, I was reading, also reading your bio, but also just sort of preparing for tonight and immersing myself in some of your writings and your videos and a bit of your story, and you shared it even there a little bit about the context of the book. And when I think about who I want to read or learn from when it comes to topics like a theology of suffering or like finding purpose in pain, I hope you don't take this the wrong way, but you seem like a really credible person in that. As I look at the intersections of living with chronic pain and suffering from undiagnosed Lyme disease and losing 7 babies from miscarriage, and I know other traumas that you have talked about and written about, and living with complex post-traumatic stress, that's a lot. That's like any just one of those is too much for a human to bear. And you are layered with many of them. And so I find myself simultaneously like annoyed at my dog for being so loud, simultaneously like aching with this sense of like, why must Stephanie shoulder so many of these? Like, spread them out. Like, let some other people have one of these. combined with this sense of, like I said earlier, oh my God, I don't know that there's anybody I want to learn this stuff from because I think she's the only one I might trust. Mm-hmm. Like, you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. And I don't like that you have earned my trust.
Yeah, again, not in a like, God did this to make Stephanie our
God, no.
Yes, but just like, if I'm going to learn about these things, I'm going to a person like Stephanie.
It's like, yeah. It's like how Pete Rollins talks about the songwriter and how the best songwriters write from the place of the deepest pain and ache of their soul. And so when we say to a songwriter, like, write me another song, we're basically saying, may more pain befall upon you. And it's like, We're not really saying that. And we're saying, I guess what I'm feeling is this gratitude that one of your ways of showing up to your life was saying yes to this purpose of sharing your writing and your speaking and your advocacy with the world, because you might be one of the few voices that has so many intersections of that sort of pain.
And letting us in and doing the work yourself to go there, because you'd be so justified in just walling off from the world and deciding not to talk to any of us jokers about this stuff. Like, truly, truly.
When I hear you say that, what I hear is, like, if I can challenge you,
thank you.
There are other voices like mine. We're just not very often platformed. And so I appreciate hearing what you say. And I would challenge you and other pastors and church leaders and to, like, this is why it's so important to not just include disabled voices in your pews, but include them on your platform. Right? To include them on your elder board and your planning committees and your whatever that looks like in your church, your organization, your whatever. Because again, like, if we really believe that it takes all of us to reflect that image of God, it means that people with different marginalized identities, whether that be disabled people, whether that be the queer community, whether that be people of color, like, they have a unique lived experience to offer something. And I think sometimes in the church, we get caught up in this idea of, like, who's theologically trained and who went to seminary. And I'm not trying to discount the role of any of that, but there's definitely a way forward for the church in which we recognize that there also needs to be space made for some of these lived experiences that can say, maybe I read the story differently. Maybe I see something different. You know, in the character of who God is because of my lived experience, can I share that with you? I cannot tell you the amount of times I'm asked now to speak specifically on, like, the healing stories of Jesus, for example, right? I don't have seminary training. That's not my background. But when I come at those stories about Jesus healing people, I can guarantee you that I read them very differently than a lot of the ways that they're commonly preached or taught. Because we don't realize sometimes the lens that we read into the way that we view God, the way that we view scripture, we don't think about the way that we all carry a bias and we all carry a lens. And so it's just really meaningful to hear that you recognize those things. But I would challenge people that there are lots of people who, like you described, like me, have multiple intersections of pain, of lived experience, of things they wish they didn't know as much about, but they do.
Oh, for sure.
And it's a gift to the church when we can seek out those kinds of voices and figure out how to learn from them and ask them to lead us.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah, thank you. Is what we are saying, is that we're so tired of that world that we grew up in where people spoke to those topics when they had no business doing so. And we just don't want any more of that. It's just, yeah, the men that have preached on those passages, like, what did they know about what that story meant? Yeah. And we do that with so
I don't think
stories.
I ever heard those stories taught in a way that was not completely ableist
until
adulthood and seeking out, like, disability theology specifically.
Yep.
Yeah.
I want so much more of my tendency. I talked about this last week with Austin, because my tendency is to just, because of the poor teachings of the Bible and the same dude telling the stories over and over again from his perspective, my tendency is to just do away with the Bible then. Like, that's just how I orient in the world, you know? And last week with Austin, I was challenged there in a beautiful, like, sobby mess way, because Austin is sharing all of the ways in which he sees trans people in the Bible in incredible storytelling and such moving ways that I was like, God damn it, not again, Kate. Like, stop walking away from the thing, because it's more beautiful to come back to the thing and just see it through other perspectives. Mm. But anyway, it made me think of Austin last week sharing all those stories. Yeah. I'm like, okay, the stories aren't necessarily the problem. It's the storytellers that we constantly have presenting them.
Oh, that reminds me. I'm glad you brought up Austin, because it reminded me that when we were, before we went live, there was a conversation we were starting to have, and I said, put a pin in that, because I would love to have that now. So last week, Austin, a transgender man, was sharing this fascinating insight into where, prior to transitioning, he carried a number of identity markers that were obviously outwardly presenting of, like, in minority groups. Mm-hmm. And then when he transitioned, now he just presents as, like,
he laughed about, now I just look like a vanilla straight white dude,
you know? And it was just this this moment of, like, oh, did I just sort of loot, like, and he has to like work through, how do I communicate,
kind of,
like,
what do I do? My marginalized identity so that people know that I am, that kind of thing, which is what we were talking in the green room with you about
performative disability.
Yeah. Like, if it's invisible, then it's invisible. Yeah.
Yeah. So can you speak to that? Can you share with us, like, your thoughts, your perspective? What do we not know about that? Or
so, performative disability is this concept that, so a lot of the times, my access needs and whether or not I'm going to be given the accessibility tools that I need are often in the hands of abled people who get to determine whether or not I really need those things, right? Whether it's a accessible parking permit or getting to pre-board the airplane, right? Or, you know, whatever the request is, there's usually an abled person who kind of looks at you and determines, do you really need this? And so one of the things that can happen is for a lot of... one of the things we like to say in disability justice is that disability is dynamic. And we don't just mean that there's a spectrum of disability between different disabilities or different people. For many of us, it means you may see me on Monday and I'm rocking high heels and, you know, I just blend right in, and then see me on Thursday and I literally, my tremor's out of control and I can't walk without my cane and I'm a mess. And I'm equally disabled on both of those days.
Yeah.
Disability is, you know, who I am. It doesn't change because I'm having a good day or a bad day. But the temptation can be, and it's not really disabled people's fault. And I have to be very careful how I word this, because there's already a culture that's very big on, like, you guys are faking it or you're exaggerating. So we have to be very careful how we talk about this in sort of mixed concepts, because it gets taken out of context. Sometimes we feel the need to do what's called perform disability, which means make sure that we show you in very exaggerated ways, like, this is the thing that's wrong with me. Please see me as disabled enough to give me my access needs. And again, the problem is not with us. We're not faking it. We're not trying to get attention. The reality is we're denied our very real needs unless we perform disability in ways that are recognized by people outside of our community. And people that aren't in our community don't always recognize disability in some of the ways that it normally shows up, because they're very used to sort of stereotypes, ideas of what it should look like. So, for example, even if I'm having a good mobility day, I will always use my cane at the airport, because I know that I need wheelchair service in order to be functional when I get to my destination. And I know I need to pre-board the plane. And oftentimes I have specific seating needs because of blood clot risk. But explaining all of that has gotten exhausting. And sometimes I get good gate agents, and sometimes I get gate agents that try to play up the power struggle and want to know if I have a doctor's note or an accessible placard. And, like, you know, technically need those things, but I've been asked for them before. So I've learned that whether I'm having a good mobility day or not, I need my cane at the airport because it shows people an outward sign of disability that they go, oh yes, that's the cripple girl. And they give me what I need. It's exhausting though.
What a nightmare.
Because it causes a lot of us with invisible disability or with dynamic disability to doubt ourselves, to question if we are just asking for too much or playing it up or faking it or abusing the system. And because a lot of these systemic barriers are set up in a way that we're trained to think that like accessibility is a pie and there's only so much to go around, right? That by meeting my needs, somebody else is going to be left out and not get what they need.
Scarcity and everything, yeah.
And it's artificial scarcity, right? Yep. The reality is there are ways that we could go back and design accessible design from the get-go so that these are not issues. But because we're determined to stick with the system we have, there is some artificial scarcity of, yes, but if you get to board the plane early and she gets to board the plane early and now we're all boarding the plane early and... So we start to doubt ourselves and question, am I disabled enough for this? Do I really count as disabled? Am I play acting marginalization, if you will? And because we get some of these messages from culture, eventually it gets to us and we do start to doubt ourselves and wonder. So it's kind of this weird... I don't ever want to make it sound like I'm saying we fake it. Like that's not what's happening. But sure. I've definitely felt pressure sometimes
you
to
have
perform
to prove.
Yeah. my disability in recognizable ways.
Yep. To prove your needs and yeah. Wow. That's so gaslighty. That'll mess with your head for sure. Yeah.
It really does. Especially for, you know, yes, it took me 15 years to get diagnosed, but the reality is I'm white. I'm partnered, right? And I was fairly well educated and pretty middle class. And all of those things combined are part of the reason that I did eventually get
diagnosed. Wow.
There are a lot of people who don't share my privilege that don't have a diagnosis officially of anything that are just as disabled as I am. Yeah. And so trying to approach their access needs when we put up these artificial barriers to keep the fakers out or whatever... it ends up further marginalizing the most marginalized in our community because there are so many women of color, especially, who will never get the diagnosis that they need. So getting on disability, like if I can't get on disability, trust me, they will never be able to get on disability. Getting a placard, getting accommodations at work, you usually have to have the right paperwork to prove that you really are what you're saying. Because we live in a society where just speaking about our lived experience isn't believed. It's not enough. So just getting a diagnosis is already an access barrier that a lot of people will never break through.
There are so many things at play there because I feel like we do that in so many different social ways where we take the fear of the random exception of some very rare asshole or sociopath, which is so rare.
Sure, it's out there.
And yeah. The fear right. of that very rare exception becomes our driving motivation for everything instead of the very real people in front of us who need something. I feel like we do that in so many areas
so
of
many
society
areas, yeah.
all of the time. And then on top of that.
That's the reason I don't have a parking permit. It's not because
wow.
I couldn't qualify for that. It's because I, when was offered the chance to apply, chose not to because I've seen enough horror stories and experienced some in other areas of accessibility where people accuse you of faking it, of, you know,
yell at
being
you
someone.
In the parking lot.
Google it. There are countless stories of disabled yeah. people who don't look disabled in the right way being accosted in parking lots by people who screaming at them for stealing somebody's placard or for using their grandma's placard or whatever. And I shouldn't have to give out my private medical information to strangers on the sidewalk every time I just want to go to the grocery store, right?
Yep.
So for me, it was just more trouble than it was worth. And I end up putting my body through things I probably shouldn't have to because it's easier than dealing with having to prove myself to strangers every 5 minutes.
Wow. Yeah, I was just going to say that, and you just spoke to exactly what I was going to say. Then there's the layer of our bent towards not believing people about their own mm-hmm. experience mm-hmm. in life, which we also do in so many areas of society. Wow. And that speaks to exactly where we started with the actual understanding of what it means to be disabled. We are not enabling.
That's right.
People.
Right.
Yeah.
We, the people, are causing the dis.
Yep. Yep, and our systems and
we can uncause it.
Yeah, there are things that we can do.
And there's no better time than right now, right? I mean,
yes.
The pandemic has given us an enormous opportunity to evaluate the ways that structural ableism is baked into our system. We're seeing, and I have to say, for the disability community, it was a really frustrating year of like I don't have a college degree. I couldn't finish it. Because the system is ableist, y'all. Like, I had tons of classes where I was doing very well, but I was automatically dropped because of the attendance policy. Doesn't matter if you're carrying your weight, you miss a certain number of classes, you're dropped. And this happened quarter after quarter after quarter until I couldn't justify doing it anymore, right? And I asked for years for accessible alternatives and was told there was just no way to do that. And then all of a sudden the pandemic hit, and once it affected all the abled people, they were like, yes, we can move completely online. Well, you can actually do it from home in your pajamas. It's totally okay. There are a lot of us who are sitting on pointless college credits that will never be a degree,
like,
going, oh, really? Like, how many jobs? There are countless disabled people that said, I could work if you would let me do this from home, that were told, yeah, we don't do that here. And now they sent everybody in the office home, and it's no problem.
Oh, y'all must have just been dying when we just suddenly made it so easy for everyone. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
But the fear is, with all of the back to normal talk, that we will just slip right back into these same structures and these same faulty systems without really taking a moment to go, does it have to be this way? Or did we always just assume it had to be this way?
Yeah.
And who was included now this last year that wasn't included before? And how can we make sure we don't go back and re-exclude those people all over again?
Yeah. Yep. I've seen it. I've seen friends who are now fighting because they were like, but we just did a whole year and a half of us working from home, and now you're telling me we have to come into the office? Do we have to?
Why do I have to sit in a chair here when I could just sit in the same chair I've been sitting in my bedroom?
Yeah. Yep.
Stephanie, thank you so much for being with us tonight and for sharing.
Vince and Alexa and Melanie, I see you and all of your personal stories here of resonating with what Stephanie is saying.
I'll have to go back and read those. Mm.
Thank you for sharing, and I'm so glad that Stephanie can be here to process this with y'all.
All right, everybody go pick up Stephanie's book.
Yep. And go, we're not leaving until we'll do lightning round in a second, but we have to talk about flowers first.
Oh, yeah.
I was kind of hoping we could just forget about lightning round since I didn't remember to cheat and pre-check all the questions.
You wanted to do some study.
I had every
of
intention of going through last week's episode and figuring out my answers, and then
okay,
I forgot.
How about this? We'll do it together. All three of us will answer all of the lightning round questions. Can we talk about flowers? What do flowers mean to you?
We can always talk about flowers.
Yeah. Tell me about your joy of flowers and what they mean to you and why your Instagram's full of them.
Oh, gosh. Well, my Instagram's full of flowers because there was this thing called a pandemic. It was worldwide. And I've been home for a year and a half trapped in my house. No, it's no exaggeration to say that last year flowers literally saved my life. Like, when every single day blurs together and you can't tell where one stops and one ends, there's something really powerful about like tangible practices of watching the seasons change, right? Mm. Of investing in tomorrow and in next week and in 3 months from now and having to like physically, tangibly believe those days are going to come. Of watching things grow and watching things die and being connected to that system. And feeling time move, even when it didn't feel like time was moving, it was so anchoring in a way that, like, it's really hard to quantify for me. Like, I could write an entire book just on the theology of the garden and theology of flowers and compost and dead things and things coming back to life and
do it.
Cycles and seasons and dirt, like physically connecting dirt. To the dirt. It's a powerful practice. And things like climate change, right? Like, you don't have to be convinced to care about climate change when you flower farm, when you garden, when you watch it happening in real time and you feel invested in the work, and then see it all wiped out by a 117 degree heat wave a week after you put your seedlings in.
No.
Yeah.
It was one of my favorite.
You don't have to be convinced to care.
Yeah.
Like, you have to care because you're watching it happen. Your hands are physically in it, in the dirt, and you cannot help but care.
Yep.
I'm all about it. I think everybody needs tangible practices that connect them to the earth, and this just happened to be mine. So.
And if every household that had a plot of soil helped make the soil healthier, our planet would be in way better shape. Thank you for sharing about your joy in that. And I think you should write that book. I want that book.
I might be working on something. We'll see.
You feel so inclined. All right, we're going to torture. We're going to torture.
That was going to be fine. Like you said, we're all going to be tortured together.
Oh, gosh.
All right. I struggled so much with this question right here, but I have my answer tonight.
Should we go in order like that? So Kate, Colby, Stephanie. So Stephanie has a little bit of time. Stephanie
has time and other people.
I like this plan. Okay. I'm proud to be a part of this plan. This is a good plan.
Favorite movie of all time. For me, it's Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet.
I would say for me, it is The Lord of the Rings. I'll take the whole trilogy, but if I have to narrow it down, it's Fellowship of the Ring.
Fellowship of the Ring.
All day, every day. Extended edition, obviously.
Obviously. Who's going to watch a 2.5-hour movie when we could watch a 4.5-hour
movie? I hate this question.
I know.
If I just go with my gut, like the literal first thing that popped into my head, it is Life is Beautiful. Buongiorno, Principessa. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a brilliant film, but you have to watch it in Italian with the subtitles if you can.
Nice.
It's better. It's a lot better than the dubbed
one. You would
one.
Agree with that.
Oh, yeah. I love subtitles.
I can't do subtitles because of some of my issues. But fill in the link. Self-care is. How do I want to fill in that blank? Let's see. Self-care is not what we say it is and market it as.
Oh, good. That answer's not cheating, so feeling. I can.
No, there's no cheating. You get to fill in that blank however you want. What about you?
Self-care is really challenging for me, maybe not for the obvious reason, but because part of self-care for me as an Enneagram Type 3 is to try to not perform and produce and achieve. And yet, when I do a thing that is like supposedly practicing self-care, it triggers off the same thing of like, yay, I did a thing. I achieved. I did it.
It's a tricky loop.
It's a tricky loop.
Yeah.
It's a tricky loop.
Yeah. How do you like ninja that loop? How do you fix that? Or do you need to?
I don't know that I figured that out. Okay. I think I live with the tension. I think I just live with, I practice the thing that I think
there,
is self-care.
I did it. Check
and
my
I know
box.
That half of
productive.
My brain is going to be like, yay. And the other half is going to be like, challenge that story a little bit.
I produced self-care. Yay. I bested it.
Check. Self-care is too often what we say to people who really need community care. I think we have a tendency to use self-care as an excuse not to meet people's needs. So we tell them that they need to get therapy and they need to take more, you know, long showers and get a pedicure when what they actually need is to not be marginalized. So there's that.
There is that. I like that a lot.
Who was it? Was that just Austin last week?
I think it was Austin last week.
Austin last week
very
filled
similar.
In the blank with community care.
Self-care is community
care. Self-care is community care. And said a very similar thing for his reason why.
Something.
I think they're on to
There's
something.
Basically a whole chapter in my book about that. So
oh, cool.
About Love Jewish it. Culture and grief and how they do sitting Shiva and how we're supposed to belong to each other in our suffering instead of doing it as an individualized thing. So
right,
I'm all
that
about
is,
it.
Yes, me too. And that is why I answered my fill in the blank the way I did, of it's not what we say it is and it's not what we market it as, because we've done what we do to everything. And I'll just speak for America because that's where I sit. But we have done what we do to everything. We've individualized it and put all of the burden and the pressure on individual humans to get their shit together and made
like,
it. This,
I don't want to spoil the whole chapter, but like it blew my mind to really dig in and learn that like, in Jewish culture, right, when someone dies and you're grieving, like in our culture, in Western, you know, white Western thought, we'd be like, take care of yourself, do extra self-care.
Exactly.
Literally sit in Shiva. They're like, don't shave, don't put on makeup, don't spend a lot of time on yourself, cover all your mirrors. Yeah. Like,
yep.
And that sounds really backwards until you read the rest of it and understand that they've pointed the community so much to these grieving people that there's no chance for them to fall through the cracks. There's no chance for them to be forgotten. The reason we can say tune outside yourself during this time is because they're being so cared and so covered by their community that their needs are still fully met and they don't have to look inward to do it anymore. Wow. It was mind-blowing. So I wrote a whole chapter about it by the book.
That. I love when lightning round isn't lightning round. It's my
I'm
favorite.
Sorry.
No, I talk a very little bit. Sincerely saying I love it. It's not a sarcastic. Oh, I love it. Not being cheeky. I really love it. Okay, deeply grateful for.
She doesn't see the question.
Okay,
so.
Name something that you're deeply grateful for right now. I'm deeply grateful for, I'm deeply grateful for my kids. Oh my God, I had to just do a whole workaround in my head of, I'm not bragging, I'm not making it seem like I have the best, and then I'm like doing the whole like fighting my story in my head thing in real time. So sorry. I'm deeply grateful for my kids who are showing so many ways in which they see other humans and looking outside of themselves and caring for each other and us and their community. And like the community care thing, I watched that show up in our kids just this week, big time. And I'm so grateful for that. It's like, oh, my kids are all right. They care. Mm-hmm. I'm really grateful for that.
Love that. I'm deeply grateful for the immense number of people that showed up at our community on Sunday, both before church and after church, to ensure that we could go back together in person and do it well. And that was huge. Like, I just get teary thinking about the people that believe in this mission so much that they give of themselves to do it.
Including shaking my stuff.
Nah. What?
Yeah. Opening up speakers where mice had moved in and were living.
Oh, yuck.
Yeah.
Yuck.
That happened. How about you, Steph? What's something you're deeply grateful for? I am
deeply grateful for the people in my life that have gone out of their way to make sure that me and my family, that we are not lost in this pandemic, that we don't get left behind and forgotten, and that have gone out of their way to circle back and anchor me and make sure that I still have those touch points that connect me to the community out there, even though I'm trapped in here. Literal lifelines this year. Like, there are specific people that show up in my texts. It's like they know. It's like the radar goes off and they know to make sure that I know that I still exist, we still exist, we're still connected, we're still part of the world out there, even if we can't be in it right now.
Community care.
Love it.
Love that. All right, this one just cracks me up every time. Weirdest fear, which really just means what's your fear? Because people just—
This came up in your comment section one time.
Yeah. So I already know yours because I remember that.
Yep.
Okay, my weird fear. I realized the other day that I have— it's not weird as in to be afraid of this is weird. It's just weird that I am so much, but I'm afraid of food poisoning, and it like comes up in me all the time of like this. Yeah, it's like a bodily like afraid of food poisoning, and I don't have reasoning behind it or experience behind it.
You didn't have, like, bad food poisoning one time, or?
Well, you know what? It's funny because I say there's no experience, but.
There it is.
This is kind of deep and dark, but I did get extremely ill from some meat, and we were so sick, and then very, very shortly after that miscarried, and whether it's true or not, in my brain, that's extremely connected. So actually, I'm realizing maybe it's not that weird. I'd never thought about that until this moment of saying it out loud. Okay, I guess it's not that weird, but yeah, I think about it way more than a person generally thinks about food poisoning. Just realizing it's trauma and I need to process it.
I love you.
I love you too. What's your weird fear?
Well, yes, I have a fear of rats, but I think it gets weird when my fear is like I'm convinced that they will crawl on me in my sleep.
Yeah.
There's just nothing you can. There's nothing you can do to convince me that that's not true. If I hear
why
them,
why did you put that in my brain?
So sorry.
Oh my god.
Yeah. Yeah, so, you do. Like you. Literally if I have are any,
if like
night,
if there's any sound or anything, I'm like they've now come in the house and they. I will. Will not
if
be
something
able to sleep.
Else makes like a noise that feels like scratching or something, then it's in his head, and then he's locked in that the rest of the night and can't sleep.
I have to put like my AirPods in and just listen to podcasts until my 4 hours my body just is like, and we're now going to force you to sleep.
that's rocks.
Okay, what about you, Stephanie? What's your weirdest fear?
Now I'm thinking about rats crawling on me in my sleep.
So now it's scary.
Okay, no, mine, and you can laugh at me. It's fine. I know it's ridiculous. I'm afraid of fish. Like,
totally remembered that as soon as you said it about the comments.
They're creepy and they're weird, and I don't get people that swim in the ocean where like they can touch you.
They can touch
or, like,
fish.
Brush up against your leg or something, or like it's
So like snorkeling in Hawaii for you.
No.
Off the table.
No.
You're like, that's not happening.
That's gross.
Or the tank at the aquarium where you put your hand in and the fish come and clean your skin because they're like a sucker.
Bobby
sucker
made me do one of those. Like basically just kept pressuring me, like touch the fish, touch the fish. Like he really thought it would be some kind of breakthrough and I would, you know, come away with an appreciation for fish and like it didn't. It
I thought
didn't
it was a nice
well.
Canadian. What happened?
Yeah,
I touched
what happened?
The starfish and that was fine, but like actual fish is like.
Starfish is different. I could see how, yeah.
Yeah.
I could see
that's
how
fine.
That one's
it's like
a ceramic figurine.
Like a rock kind of.
Yeah, totally.
We saw that thing in Mexico where people like put their feet in and like. It's like a pedicure you do now. It's like a tank full of fish and they come
they
and like suck
world.
On your toes and.
Yep.
Why?
No.
And they pay money. Like, they pay money for this.
Oh, yeah. People, like,
they don't win prize
like
money at the end. It's not fear factor. Like, they
fear
pay
factor.
To do it.
It's not fear factor.
It's gross.
Donna Jamie Whitaker says, I had fish nibble on my feet when I lived in Japan.
No.
Like, good for you. Bully for you.
Let's go back to talking about rats crawling on us in our sleep. Let's do that. Let's talk about
you're
that
like, that's
again.
Actually better. Okay, who's a famous person that you swear you'd be besties with if only you knew each other?
Oh, boy.
Crap,
it's
I
fictional.
Really, I have a really good answer for this, and yet it's not coming to my head. Who's yours? Maybe mine will come to me.
So I have, we've done this now. This is our 21st episode, so we've asked this question 21 times.
Okay.
And each time, the thing that comes to my mind is nobody. Like, I don't think that I would actually be besties with anybody. I think I have just such a low view of my capacity for friendship that I'm like, there's nobody that I would be friends with.
Brad Pitt. Just say Brad Pitt.
You've been in California too long.
Is that what it is?
Oh my gosh. I swear
mine's
I have a great answer.
Fictional, but I'm going to go with Leslie Ngo.
I like it.
Leslie Ngo, I love it.
It's
a great
oh
answer.
Oh my God, I love it. We are rewatching
it. We just
Parks
started
Rec
last
right
week
now,
rewatching it again.
That's
so
amazing.
We are enjoying
it's hysterical.
Nope. And
That is really hysterical.
Ron Swanson.
I really can't think of one for myself, but I swear I have a really good one. Oh, you know what? I don't know if this is true. No, it is true. My favorite writer. I would totally be besties with Neil Gaiman. Like, absolutely.
Oh,
like,
that's
weird,
a good
just
answer.
The same amount of dark and twisty and weird, and he would be my bestie.
I see that.
Okay.
You and Tim, not Tim Halliburton. That's not his name. Tim Burton.
No, he's two.
He's two.
No.
He's two?
In a, not, yeah, no.
Interesting.
Like, cool, make some weird shit, but not, like, person in real life. Whereas Neil and I would, like, be buds. We would, like, sit and drink coffee, and I would enjoy his dark, weird, twisty brain.
Okay.
Anyway.
What's all figured out.
What's a book that you feel like everyone should read? It doesn't have to be because it's serious. It's just, like, what's a book that, like, people would just really need to experience this?
You're supposed to go first.
Oh, yeah.
Give me time to think.
Okay, the everyone on this question always trips me up a bit, but I do feel like Braiding Sweetgrass is an everyone. Mm. If you're going to do an everyone on something, just that, the Stephanie talking about the dirt and the death and nature and the cycles.
That's your jam.
The earth just. So
have you read that one, Stephanie?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. It's a good book.
I call it my Bible, so.
I think my answer to this is Sapiens by Yuval Noah Harari.
Yeah. You quoted that more than any
I think everyone should read that to have just this large view scale understanding of our species and how we came to be and why we came to be.
I love it.
I got a weird one.
Bring it.
It is kind of a classic, but are you familiar with Barbara Kingsolver? She wrote, most people know The Bean Trees, but have you ever read The Poisonwood Bible?
No.
I've heard of it. Why have
the
I heard of it?
The start of my deconstruction really was that this was one of the possible books I could choose for like a lit paper at my conservative Christian high school.
Wow.
And I don't think they understood. I don't think they understood what the book is really about because, like, the start of my deconstruction was reading that book. It's That's fictional, amazing. But it's, like, it's the account of, like, a Baptist preacher who drags his family to Africa to be missionaries. And the book keeps changing narrators through his different daughters. It's all daughters and his wife. And their experiences of essentially deconstruction and loss of faith and how that looks different for them and how some of them refind it and some of them decide, wow, we're colonizers. And some of them, like, it's just totally different directions for each of them. And it was just a brilliantly written story that was like, wow, I don't know why my high school assigned this book, but okay. And it started totally me down. Like, that was clearly the point where my deconstruction started, was reading that book.
Wow. I love that. I love being able to point to fiction and say that that's where your deconstruction started. That was true for you, but it was Brian McLaren.
Yeah, it was faux fiction. He was smuggling in
I his literally memoir. Go back and read that book again, like, every 5 or 6 years. And it's brilliant.
Yeah.
That's awesome. It's brilliant.
Donna hopped on here and said it's an amazing book, so you've got to. Friend in that. Okay.
Last question,
and this is just how we wrap up every week on the Kate and Cole Show, asking everyone this question: what's sustaining your soul right now? What's keeping you going? What is keeping me going right now? You know what I'm going to answer this week with? What's keeping me going right now is my own knowing and my own gut and my own compass, like the way that I have been able to get to this place in life out of evangelical Christianity that taught me not to in so many ways, with so many layered pieces on my identity and that, and my story and that, to now be able to get to this point where I can trust my own voice, and actually to the point where when I'm struggling, like I shared at the beginning of the show, when I'm having a hard time, my go-to now is to look to myself instead of desperate clinging to who's going to get me out of this and yeah. who's going to help me, which is what my go-to used to be. Now my go-to is, okay, Kate, how are we going to do this? And walking myself home. And that's keeping me going right now. This week I have survived by looking to myself and saying, how are we going to do this?
Love that. Thanks for sharing. What's sustaining my soul right now? I would say is we recently had family move nearby. And so to have my brother and my sister-in-law and my nephews, so and so our boys, our kids to have their cousins, that has been, that's been soul given for weeks now. How about you, Steph?
This was supposed to be lightning round.
You're good.
But I got to write a piece the other day, circling back to my absolute like favorite discovery in disability theology. And I can't, like, every time I talk about it or write about it, or like, it's just front of brain material for like the next 2 weeks, right? Like, you cannot stop seeing it everywhere. And it's the idea that I serve a disabled savior, that when Christ came back fully glorious, conquered death, he came back with a literal gaping wound in his side that he told his friends to plunge their hand in, and literal gaping wounds in his hands that he told his friends to stick their fingers in. Not little speckled dots like in the paintings the way we grew up. Not like, it's just a little freckle to show you the story really happened, but a literal stick your hand in my side gaping wound. That he conquered death and yet still came back physically unhealed means that for somebody in a body like mine who isn't physically healed, who doesn't have a body that functions the way the world says it should function, like, I am not going to be a reflection of God when I get to heaven and it's all fixed. But the idea of getting to heaven, having it be all fixed, might even be flawed to begin with. That I serve a savior that came back with a gaping hole in his side, that he looks like me and I look like him, and I am a reflection of God right now in my broken body, is like completely life-giving for me. Completely life-giving for me. Turns the whole New Testament on its head and flips everything upside down in ways that are just, yeah, life-giving in the best possible way.
Changes everything.
What a gorgeous way to end our conversation.
That was a perfect way to wrap that up. Thank you so much.
I could have just said flowers, but it wasn't but I'm glad the thing you did on it. The front of my brain. No.
That was what we needed to hear. That was what the moment needed.
Yep, and that is what people needed.
Stephanie, we send all of our love and our light to you for however you need it in the days and weeks to come. And we're so grateful for you and your voice and all of what you bring to life and how you share. So thanks for sharing with us tonight here on the show.
Thanks for having me, friend.
All right. Good night.
We'll see you out there on the internet.
Bye.
Okay. So between Austin last week.
One of my top favorite conversations there was.
Yes, that plummeted to the top of my favorite conversations we've ever had on the Kate and Colby Show. Between Austin last week with his stories about Jesus and stories about people in the New and Old Testament and their encounters with human life and God. And then tonight, it through a transgender view of things. And then tonight with Stephanie, hearing her share what's sustaining her soul of a save, the way she said that, a savior with gaping wounds, like, anyway, between those two, I feel like maybe I'm a Christian again.
I love you. I'm with you. I hear you.
If I am, it's because of those two humans and their storytelling. Those are Jesus's and stories and
so good
Bible stories that I can find beauty and truth in.
Anyway. So good.
Yep. Well, so grateful.
I'm glad
so
we keep doing this show.
Yes, I was just going to say the same thing. So grateful that we get to do this.
And we're going to do it again for the next couple weeks.
What do we got?
Next week, The one, the only, Paula Stone Williams is going to come back on the show.
Thank God, because we lost
her. We had the worst computer shutdown, like 2 months ago. Anyway, some of you remember that. So she's going to be back next week. We love talking with Paula, one of our dear friends for several years now. And then we get to meet a brand new human in Shelby Forsythia.
I'm so excited.
Who has written a book on grief and the loss of her husband. Yeah. And so we get to dive into that.
I love meeting new people, and especially when they want to talk about grief.
And then... one of the theologians. One of the writers, professors, theologians that have done the most for me in my life is Richard Beck. And if I could have him as, like, just, if I could shrink him and put him on my shoulder and carry him around with me for my entire life, I would.
He has been one of those humans through. And in real life, flesh and blood with us, like, walked us through dark times then.
Can we just make a field trip to Texas in a couple months?
Yes.
All right, we'll visit Richard.
Why do we want to go to Texas? Because Richard Beck.
Okay, love you all. Thank you for being with us tonight. See you next week. Good night.
If you enjoy The Kate and Colby Show, here are a few ways that you can support us. Subscribe to our podcast feed on whatever platform you use. And when you do, go ahead and leave us a review or rating. This will help others discover our show. Find and follow us on social media using the handle @KateandColby. And speaking of social media, we'd love it if you share our show with your friends. Everyone is looking for a great podcast recommendation, so help them and us out. Finally, if you visit us at kateandcolby.com, you can subscribe to our newsletter, learn more about us, the hosts, and discover great resources for coming more alive. The Kate and Colby Show is recorded in San Diego and produced by Holy Living Studios. Thank you for your love and support. We do this show for you, our pod fam. Until next time, be